Well, welcome back. You've had a great opening panel with Brian Kenney and John Shambi, and then Sean Forman's deep dive on war, which was very interesting. And now we're going to continue the dialogue with another panel. I think what we're going to do is we're going to end up hitting on a lot of the same topics that Brian Kenney and John Shambi discussed. We'll be probably a little less humorous. I'm just warning you now.
So you're saying we're not funny?
Well, I'll tell you. You weren't here for that. That was a pretty high bar. They were quite the act.
I'm aggressive.
But we'll again get into some of the issues. So first, right here on my right, immediate right, is Mike Farron. Mike, you know from his work on Sirius XM. The show that he co-hosts with who these days?
Jim Duquette.
Jim right. Duquette, yeah. And it's a great listen, 10 o'clock Eastern time every morning, and it's a really fun listen. Also does play-by-play for the Diamondbacks. Next to him is Eduardo Perez. You know him from ESPN, where he does play-by-play, but he also is on Sirius XM on the morning show, teams with Steve Phillips. 3 days a week, and has done a terrific job on that. And he also has another credential we like to mention every once in a while, and that is the son of Tony Perez, the great Hall of Famer. Next to him is Emil Sade. Emil is a senior vice president and assistant general manager for the Arizona Diamondbacks, and he came over to the D-backs 2 years ago after 15 years in the Boston Red Sox organization in baseball ops. And then finally, on the far end is Eno Saris. Eno, you know from his work at Fangraphs, where he has done some tremendous work over the years. Honestly, one of my favorites to read. I just told him that he's probably the reason I just subscribed to his new employer, which is a subscription service, theathletic.com. I urge you to spring for the $59 a year if you can afford it, and read Eno and all the other great writers on The Athletic. It's really a treat. It's that level of depth that you're looking for if you're here at a conference like this. So with that, I thought we would just get started. And what we're going to do for the next hour or so is bat around some topics of what's going on in the game today. This will have a little bit of a look and feel, as I said, like the first panel. I also want to remind you, write down your questions on cards. You can give them to Jeff Schatzky or put them somewhere in the back of the room, and Jeff will bring them up to us so that we can save the last 10 or 15 minutes for questions. Let me start with you, Mike. I want your reaction to this winter of free agency that we saw. I think it caught a lot of people by surprise, the gridlock, the lack of movement in the market, and now some of the prices that we're seeing as we hit the deep end of the market, the tail end, where Mike Moustakas is making a little more than half of what Luke Gregerson is making. Is that something that you astutely predicted, say, 3 months ago?
No, I did not. I think my estimation was probably closer to what I read on Fangraphs today, what they were guessing, 5 and 85, or between that, 5 and 95. It's definitely weird. I'm sure Amiel probably could answer this better because he was actually in negotiations, but the sense that I got from teams is that they wanted players, but that the market had shifted. And I think you're looking at, so there were a number of factors, and there's two ways to look at this. One, from the Players Association standpoint, which is, well, everybody is trying to make sure that they're keeping spending down, or two, to kind of look at what happened individually. We took a couple of major spenders out of the market, ones who had been not afraid to spend above the qualifying offer limit in the past in Detroit and San Francisco for different reasons. San Francisco not wanting to give up the second pick in the second round, which is understandable because they lost 98 games, and Detroit because there's no reason to sign a qualifying offer free agent, especially when you're going to lose those picks if you have the number one overall pick. So one and two were both luxury tax payees, and so would have lost a number of draft picks. You have about a third of the league that's in some level of rebuild, and maybe in the case of some of the bigger market teams like Philadelphia and the Chicago White Sox, a year ahead of when they would likely be adding players to the mix. So now you've got a dozen teams that are out. And then you have a weird market in some cases where, like if you use Moustakas, which contending teams need a third baseman, especially when the Angels signed Zach Cozart, who was a shortstop, to play third. originally they were going to sign to play second, and then they traded for Kinsler, and Cozart was the only spot for third. So there's been a bunch of different things that have, I think, impacted this market. I've read some pieces about how the qualifying offer continues to impact. I think it did with those two teams. But I'm sorry, if you're not willing to give up a third-round pick to sign Mike Moustakas, then you aren't properly valuing where you're going to get players like Mike Moustakas in the draft. The return on getting somebody who's a below-average regular in the third round, that's a win, you know, at that point. When you start to see the way that those above-average players go down the board, you don't find many of them after, really, the compensation round. So I think all of those things were factors into why it happened in free agency, and I think that you know, there's still a benefit for teams to not necessarily be competitive if they don't have to open the window sooner than they need to.
Yeah. Eduardo, what's your take on this? I mean, it was pervasive, and even on a more macro level, you know, we're seeing guys who we thought would get close to $100 million, and they're not getting anything near that.
Right, and to add on to what Mike just said, and he's right, it's also the unexpected positioning of a lot of teams going via the trade market, being able to improve if it's a third base for San Francisco with Longoria. By adding that third base spot, that also eliminated and made it a lot easier for San Francisco to upgrade without having to lose that draft compensation pick. And it continued the trades. The Marlins, even though they traded their outfielders, all three of them, that applied a void if it's to Carlos Gonzalez, for example, that just re-signed with Colorado. So then again, you have all these domino effects that happened via the trade that a lot of the agents weren't foreseeing, that had not been done in the past. So much aggressiveness with teams rebuilding, almost 10 teams. It's just been the perfect storm when it comes to it. But if you tell me, I was very surprised with Mike Moustakas getting what he mm-hmm. got. The amount, $5.5 million and $2.5 in incentives. It's just the way that the teams right now are valuing the players. It's just like the way I shop. I don't shop at Nordstrom's. I shop at Nordstrom's Rack. I'm waiting for that product to go down. So it's the same product, but guess what, guys? I'm wearing it. You might have paid more for it, but it still is functional.
Yeah, yeah. From a club perspective, Emil, I mean, you know, we don't expect any trade secrets, of course, but what, shed some light on this from a club perspective.
Yeah, I think they both hit it on the head. I mean, especially what Eduardo just said. I mean, one of the big things I think that probably wasn't talked about enough, and maybe because you probably don't hear about it, is I do think there was a lot of trade chatter and trades that took a long time to actually materialize. And I think when you're waiting and waiting and waiting, you know, you're at the 10-yard line, but you can't punch it through just yet. You still hope that that's going to happen. And, you know, and I think, you know, speak for us. I mean, we had a lot of balls up in the air from a trade perspective and ended up with Steven Souza. But I think that took us a while. And I agree with Eduardo's point of, and I don't know, you know, how the agents looked at it, but I also think, you know, I had been talking to an agent who said, well, I know who all the outfielders on the trade market are, and you're not going to find a better outfielder than this guy. And I said, I don't think you know that this guy that we're about to get is on the trade market. And then when we got him, he's like, wow, I didn't realize you guys were going to be able to get that guy. So I think that there was a bit of that, you know, where everybody was expecting, yes, Ozuna and Yelich and Stanton, and those guys were going to get traded, but there were probably some other guys that were movable targets, and so I think that was a big part of
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and what's your take on it, Eno? I want to hear where you're coming from on this.
Well, you know, just listening to Emil talk, it occurs to me this was the shortest offseason ever, and I think because the postseason keeps getting longer, and we're starting March 29th as we are. That probably caused a bunch of a crunch. Like some of these March signings would have been February signings. So some of that is just because of the calendar almost, and the kind of waiting around that you had to do on these trades. So we'll probably see the most active March ever. but at the same time, I'm kind of disappointed, I think, is a word I would use, because I see a sort of stratification between the upper and lower class. There's no middle class anymore. And like a team like the Twins, I'm like, why aren't you signing one of these pitchers? I mean, they got so far last year without a pitching staff. And so, you know, I'm like, why not add some arms? You're right in the mix projection-wise. You're right there for the second wild card. The Angels have been active. The Blue Jays have done their depth thing. And, you know, the Twins have made some moves, but I feel like I'm looking at certain teams and being like, yeah, I'm almost, and another weird word to use is proud of the Giants. Because, you know, everyone's saying, oh, you guys are terrible, 98 losses, you know, why you should be blowing it up. And here's a middle-class team. I mean, I don't mean middle-class in terms of money, but here's a sort of middle, second wild-card projected team that went out and did a lot to improve their team.
Absolutely. And I want to come back to something you said, which is about the stratification and about the haves and the have-nots. But before that, let me just weigh in on this question on the free agency. You know, I think the other thing that's happened is we've finally gotten enough evidence and data about the performance of historical contracts in the post-steroid era. Let me just give you a few numbers. Josh Hamilton, when he signed in 2012 with the Angels, do you know what a marginal win on that contract cost? $36 million. Okay? So if you looked at his contract divided by the WAR he delivered over that contract, $36 million. But that's probably an outlier, right? Wrong. Prince Fielder, $32 million per marginal win. Carl Crawford, $27 million per marginal win. Matt Kemp, $25 per marginal win. Hanley Ramirez, he's got a year left, $110 per marginal win. Pablo Sandoval, you cannot calculate it because it's negative WAR.
Oh my God.
And there's $95 million in the numerator and negative 2 WAR in the denominator. So, you know, even Pujols, right? Listen to this. Pujols averaged 7.5 wins per season in his 11 seasons in a Cardinal uniform. And I don't know, maybe you knew that it was time to let him go, but I thought, wow, that's a lot of guts for the Cardinals to let him walk. He's at $19 million per marginal win, and he's got 4 years left on the contract. In this past year, he was minus 2 WAR. So that 19 per win is actually, you know, it's got a chance to creep up even further. So, you know, and by the way, I want to give you the other side of it, because there is a contract out there who I believe is going to still stand the test of time over the remaining 6 years, and that's Joey Votto. Joey Votto's deal, and it was an extension, is coming in at $4.5 million per marginal win. But that's Joey Votto, one of the greatest hitters of our generation. So I do think there's ample evidence now, and I think teams are wise to this, and I think teams have finally gotten to a point where they're reluctant to step out. And spend the big dollars, especially on the 30-plus-year-olds. I want to come back to something you said, Eno, and we'll start with you on this, and that is the stratification, the haves, the have-nots, the economic structure that's in the game today that has led to the phrase, popularizing of the phrase tanking. You know, and what tanking really is the acknowledgement that it's not about having the best players you can have. It's about having enough good players at a window in time to compete, right? Do you think we have a crisis in the game because of this, and that the economic structure needs to be resolved? Because teams are acting, I think, fairly rationally towards this. What's your take?
It's given the rules that they agreed to, given the collective bargaining agreement, I think that everyone is acting sort of rationally. The problem is that it leads to subpar play in certain markets, and I don't know if the answer is a salary floor. I don't know how to counteract that. I do know that there are teams that are sort of building high variance 500 teams. It's sort of kind of the Billy Beane approach. He does try to improve it every year, even though he understands that his team is going through cycles. And I'm surprised that other teams, you know, it does seem like some teams are doing that. When people talk about the Rays tanking, they have a lot of upper minors talent that's right here. And when they went and traded, and got guys who are like going to be on the major league team this year. So, there was a little bit more of a reloading. I don't have an answer for it. I don't know how to, I don't know if it's broken. I definitely don't know how to fix it.
Emil, do you think the structure is still works today, or do you think we need to get to a point where there's perhaps a different set of incentives?
I think it works. I think we're, like every other CBA that we go into, I think we're going to walk into it with, you know, the prior 5 years and say, what do we need to improve? How do we need to get this thing better for the game? And I think both the player side and the team side are going to look at it. You know, it's tough to say that a team is, I mean, I know in the media, you're like, everybody is going to say, well, these X amount of teams are tanking, but I mean, working on the team side, I don't ever hear that word. And I just know everyone wants to win, and you try to put the best product on the field. And I've been fortunate to be around a team that did go for it. And, you know, we are going for it. And I think, so yeah, we're going to have to, I think, massage what's, you know, the financial structure and the rules. And I think that's obvious, but again, I don't know how to fix it. I'm definitely not smart enough, so.
I told you I was going to make this fun.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
You're going to moderate? Are you going to moderate?
No, I'm not going to moderate.
Somehow I'm the only guy on the team up here.
I'm going to add on to you as you're the only team representative here. I was on a team that was tanking. I was the bench coach for the 2013 Houston Astros. It was 111 losses, all right? There was a game we were playing against the Yankees, and looking at our roster, our active roster, 1 through 25, you add it all up, our total budget was $14.2 million on that field and on the bench. We looked to the right, we looked to the left, and we said, boys, we don't have a chance. That's the bottom line. That, to me, is tanking. What I'm seeing right now with organizations is, I see some teams taking a deep breath and saying, okay, we're going to go after the guys we want, maybe not this year, but maybe next year. What I'm seeing is a lot of teams in the same position where they're, and it's plenty of them, maybe it's 10 teams, where they're falling under the category of tanking because they have to evaluate who they have within the organization that's still going to be there when they become competitive. The problem is when those 10 teams become competitive, then you're going to have a feeding frenzy, and then that's where it's going to be interesting, where everything will neutralize. I think sometimes we're over-exaggerating it because of my experience in 2013 with the Astros. See, this side of the head, that's all Astro. This is all gray. And it's because of all those losses and because of the growing pains of watching a team lose to be able to get, if it's a high draft pick, not just 1 year, but 2 and 3 years. If it's to make those trades and restock your minor league system, listen, they're good. They're really good now, and it's because of those growing pains that they had for those 3-4 years, just like the Cubs, just like the Royals. But we're seeing a lot of teams now, and this is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I see this a lot as a copycat league when it comes to things and situations like this. And it's unfortunate that we're calling it tanking, but I just don't see it that way unless you get your organization down to a $25, maybe $30 million payroll, which we're not seeing right now. That's tanking.
I think both things can be true. To what Amiel said, I think every team does want to win championships, but not everyone wants to go into the season winning. And I think part of that is because they are trying to build a championship roster or championship organization top to bottom. So I think that is a huge part of what we see with this. I also think that a major reason why you have seen this happen so much in the last 6 years specifically is because the amount of money you can spend on amateur talent is directly proportionate to the number of games you lose in a given season. It's not about having the number one overall pick. It's about having the amount of money that comes with the number one overall pick so that you can spread that out talent-wise throughout your draft. And the same goes internationally. And for all of the complaints about the Players Association, I think that they deserve a lot of forgiveness from some of the things that they did. I think they've been much maligned. But the one thing that they did do was they sold out the amateur players in each of these last two CBAs. It's a lot easier to create a middle-class scenario, like Eno suggests, if you're, say, Kansas City in 2008 to 2011, where they tried like hell to put a competitive team on the field while also spending more money in the draft than anybody else did. And nobody can do that anymore. And furthermore, there is no great advantage to going through the full-blown rebuild anymore. I had a scout who's very, very smart that I think some people in this room know, who pointed this out to me about a month ago. If everybody is doing it, if there are 10 teams now that are going through some form of the rebuild, well, then where's the advantage in it? Because now you're basing for the same pool of talent, right? We just saw all these teams sit out the free agent market now. They're all going to be engaged in it next year. That'll probably drive prices up on some of the stars, but not all of those players are going to end up on all of those teams, which then spreads that window out even further, which then puts them further down the road into a rebuild, which then starts costing people jobs. And that, to me, is what we're seeing now. The biggest impact to me is that we have tied amateur spending to wins and losses at the major league level, and that's why we're going down this road.
And actually, I just want to react to that really quickly. You know, people would like to try and blame sabermetrics or analytics for where we've gotten, and that it's all about evaluating contracts and evaluating agent curves and all that stuff. I actually, I usually take issue with that because I say sabermetrics is just, or analytics is just about using your resources effectively. And if it's not going to be in free agency like this, then there's got to be other ways to use that money because everyone's going to spend their money. The problem is that we've now made it illegal to spend money internationally more. Yep. Too much more. You know, you can't do it there. You can't do it there. You can't do it in the draft. You can't. So all of a sudden, I mean, you can go build like an. I mean, I know Milwaukee's like going to build this awesome sports science lab. You know, I mean, you can do that, but you can't do it on players. So I guess that's why development to me is one of the last places where you can try and separate yourself.
Yeah, and you know, this whole area of talent evaluation is really the difference maker, right? And there's so many tools now to evaluate talent, analytical tools that come from devices measuring performance in game, but also neuroscience tools and all sorts of mental measurements. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, in the organizations you've been around, Eduardo, you've seen the deployment of these tools probably at a very, you know, very sophisticated level. I mean, what are some of the things that not everybody is aware of in the public domain that's going on now behind the closed doors and evaluating talent?
Yeah, and that's actually been, I remember when it was in its infancy, before we used to, when I was with the Angels, when they were called the California Angels, that's way back then, huh? It was Kenny Revisa, which now is with the Chicago Cubs. He used to always just come around and you're like, uh-oh, I'm in trouble if he came around, because you're thinking that he's going to try to help me mentally, always with positive thoughts. The mental approach, you sort of thought of it as a negative when he was around. Now it's more of a positive when he's around. The Cubs implement it big time. We know the Seattle Mariners are implementing it big time, not only at the major league level, but also at the minor league level, especially with Andy McKay, which we'll have tomorrow also as one of the panelists. He's a psychologist and he runs the minor league organization, the player development. And it just tells you the necessary fact and the reality of how much noise on the outside can affect what happens on the inside when it comes to the players and their well-being. And we've seen it with a lot of players affecting, if it's anything in their personal daily routine or whatever, the organizations know. They look at, they have a metric system for it. Some organizations do. They value it a little bit heavier than others. But I still think it's at its infancy more than it is at its norm with a lot of organizations.
I've got a great story about that. So John Baker, who does mental skills, that's sort of what you're talking about, I think, mental skills for the Cubs, he told me he was playing with Hanley, and they were doing video work before the game. And he looks over, and Hanley's only watching home runs on himself. Just watching him hit home runs. And he's like, Hanley, are you just watching yourself hit home runs? And he goes, yeah, man, I don't know what it is when it feels good. You know, I just want to feel good. And so he's like, all right, it's all right. So he goes back and does his video work, and he looks over, and Hanley's watching the pitcher. He's only watching the pitcher give up bombs. And he's like, Hanley, are you only watching the pitcher give up bombs? He goes, yeah, man, all I do is hit home runs. All he does is give up bombs.
That's advanced analytics.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, they built a whole program based on that idea.
You know, Emil, I've heard, talked to some people in the Red Sox organization, and I know, you know, you were early on the train of the neuroscience stuff there, and you know, I've heard some phenomenal stories about how Mookie Betts scored on some of those things. And here's a guy who didn't play a lot of baseball, but he was off the charts, I'm told, on some of the neuroscience measures in terms of ability to recognize pitches and so forth. Do you see that as something that teams are pretty much catching up now, or are there still, you know, pockets out there? I know there's a lot of things going on in the vision sphere as well, eyesight, which is critically important for pitch recognition. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think some of the stuff we had in Boston, it's hard for me to talk about it because I'm not with Boston anymore, but I think, like, going back to Mookie, and yes, the story behind Mookie was he was a high score on the neuroscouting, but I'll say this, it still goes back to the people, it still goes back to the scouting, you know, I mean, the neuroscience application was a component of what we did in the draft, and it was, and that was in its infancy stage. That was the beginning of, it was, you know, we didn't know what data we had. We were kind of gathering data. Looking back on it now makes us look really smart, saying, "Oh, we were ahead of the curve." And, but, you know, he part of the story with Mookie was, he was a basketball player, so he didn't get out and play baseball till late because his team went really deep into the state championship. He was from Tennessee. If he was from Atlanta, he probably would have never got to the fifth round because he would have been overscouted. And he had a lot of rain that year. Truth be told, he was a hard guy to see. So I think, you know, we kind of married the two. You know, our guys really liked him, had seen him in the summer. He had really good hand eye. You could tell when you go to a game, you watch this kid, he's not strong yet, but really good hand eye, really good plate discipline, all the components of a hitter, the things that you like to see. And then you had this kind of validation through, like, this neuroscouting. So it wasn't that neuroscouting drove it. It was a little bit. And so I think I can't speak for other teams, but I think most teams still value all the analytics stuff that we get, and we're getting different things every year, and there's a lot of things that you use as just test drives. But you value them as a point and information, like, so there are a bunch of neuroscience, neuroscouting type applications out there, and I don't know all of them. I know the ones that we've used. I would never draft off of it. Yeah. I mean, just to let you know, I would never. It doesn't matter if a guy they said, "Oh, this guy is elite. He's never scored higher than this," and nobody's ever scored higher than this. But we just don't have enough data and proof that's.
Yeah.
And so I think some of the stuff that Eno talked about earlier, which was how you can get an edge, neuroscouting, vision, those are areas to get an edge in, whether it's an amateur talent or maybe it's even in the pro side, international side. Every team is doing something different to try to get an edge because that's what we do. We're like we said, the money's even now. So whether it's in evaluators, whether it's in analysts, whether it's in data, the information that you get. So anyways, that's kind of a little bit of a backstory with the neuroscience program.
Yeah, it's great. Mike, thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, any edge that teams can get, they're going to you know, try and take advantage of. I don't have a whole lot of information or background information on some of the data science behind it. I mean, outside of, you know, things that I've seen places like here at Sabre Seminar and just kind of what some of the cutting edge stuff is that people are working on. I will say I'm really interested in how these new virtual reality devices work for hitters. And I know actually the president of the Diamondbacks, Derek Hall, spoke about this publicly, that was something that was being tested to see whether or not there was any benefit to that for hitters, so you could get a better feel for the shape of pitches from pitchers than just by watching on video and kind of give you that real feel experience. I don't know if it's any good or not. I don't know if it might screw up a hitter or not. I'm sure it probably varies from time to time. But I do think that there's overall, I think that you know, one of the great frontiers is always understanding the soft science side of it.
That's right.
That's really, really important. I mean, they are, after all, every player is a human being. And so, you know, for some guys, the Ken Revises of the world may work. Others, it may cloud their mind. You know, for others, you might get a little bit of data from the neuroscience where maybe it doesn't tell you everything and everything else. You've got to be able to find some sort of balance with all of it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one of the things I'll talk about in the morning in my research presentation on differentiating performance versus potential in young players is the, and I just want to throw it out to the group, is this importance of assessing a young player's aptitude for learning and ability and willingness, mental ability to make changes and to allow new information in. And we've all heard stories of guys who you start to talk to them, and maybe you've done it from the media side, and they've said, oh, whoa, I don't need any of those thoughts in my mind. And they just literally can't cope. They don't want to. That's not how they're wired. Now, maybe that's changing, and an individual can change, and a lot of the younger players, I think, are coming up thirsty for knowledge. You tend to get into very in-depth conversations with folks kind of really inside their head. I mean, what about this notion of the aptitude for learning and change?
Well, I think about a conversation I had with Zach Greinke a while back, and I was talking to him about Jake Odorizzi, and I said, isn't it kind of strange that he was drafted for his fastball and his slider? I think he was like drafted as a sinker slider guy, and now he's a four-seam split guy in the majors? Like, he's not the same guy at all. Like, how did they know that he would become a major leaguer? And well, Zach's like, well, they didn't. he also said that, like, that he thought makeup was important. And it's interesting to hear a guy like Zach Greinke say that, because I've always thought for a long time that we shouldn't think too hard about makeup, because makeup is sort of like looking at Yelp reviews for service. It's like always like, oh, well, that person didn't like that person, you know, but maybe I will like him. You know, like, I don't want my scouts out there being like, why, he's really likable. I don't care, you know. So that's why I've thought, like, I don't want to know about makeup so much. And it's interesting to think about, like, Zach Greinke, you know, like, borderline autistic. And then Jake Odorizzi, who's much more affable, and to, like, think that both of these guys have plus makeup, and that we have to evaluate that somehow. It's important. It's very important. But evaluating it is super hard.
Yeah. I mean, Emil, what's your thought on the concept of valuing that people's ability to make changes?
Yeah, it's the toughest thing we do. We've been talking about applying analytics to, you know, whether it's a valuation model or whether it's this vision testing. I mean, we don't have anything. There's no science behind makeup. You know, you can have every team has their own psych evaluation and person that's an expert and can help you navigate through a person's aptitude and mind. But, you know, I can tell you there have been a lot of guys that we've drafted that have played through the minor leagues that I thought had unbelievable makeup that turned out to be, I mean, you know, for all intents and purposes, they didn't have good major league makeup. They didn't have good baseball makeup. They may not have even been a good person. And unfortunately, in the game that we're in, especially on the amateur side, we're limited. You know, we go into the draft. You know, we don't get as much opportunity to spend time with these kids. You know, we kind of, especially when they're in college. You know, we have to do as much digging as we can through the college coaches and through ex-players and teammates and people that you know, but it's very basic, right, when you really think about it.
And they're always one going to say nice things.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
It's like nobody wants to dig a grave for somebody they just played with.
That's right. And so we've always tried to go away from just that person that's somewhat invested in, like the high school coach. Of course he wants that kid to get to the major league so he can put a sign up that says, so-and-so's field. But it's hard.
Yeah. And of course, makeup, you know, we're using the word makeup to represent ability to learn, but makeup means so many different things. It's how good a teammate are you? How do you deal with stress and adversity? But I was focusing more specifically, on this learning aptitude kind of concept. But I don't know, what's your sense in being with the clubs you've been with?
Did you ask Eduardo?
Yeah, I was just asking Eduardo.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, either way.
It's all right.
No, I don't want it. Yeah. Believe me. No, I'm done.
And it's not only with the clubs that I was with, it's also with the clubs that I sort of pretty much witnessed in the clubhouse since I was a kid, and being able to be in the dugout since I was 13 years of age. So watching the Philadelphia Phillies in 1983, watching Mike Schmidt, Matthews, you can keep on going, Maddox, all these guys, they just watching them play, Pete Rose, Joe Morgan, the way they went about the game is pretty much my experience and what I wanted always to share with my teammates. And if it was when I went to college at Florida State and then when I was in the minor leagues, I think it comes down to coachability more than anything. When you call, and what you're talking about is, are you coachable or not?
Right.
Are you going to look at a person in their eyes and take what they are giving you with a grain of salt or not, or take a little bit of what they teach you and be able to implement it into your game? And I think this is really important in today's game where it's really rare to find, because once you go into a clubhouse, it's not like it was in the 80s when I was a kid, or in the 90s, or even in the early 2000s. Everybody's on their iPad. Everybody's on their iPhone. Now, there's no communication amongst the players, so in reality, the players don't know their own teammates. And I have to get away from baseball really quick on this one, as I was invited to go to dinner with the Golden State Warriors in Miami while they were on a road trip last year.
Name dropper.
I know, I have to, sorry. I knew you were going there, but it's all right. I'll wear it. And when they were what the organization does, and I thought it was really cool, and it's pretty much almost impossible to do in baseball because of so much travel and so many guys that are there. But in order for them to have a good makeup as a team, they go to dinner every night on the road after the game or on their days off. And the ownership pays for the dinner. It's an open, get anything you want on the menu with the best restaurant in Miami at the time. It was Prime 112. I hope I get a free dinner out of it. And then after that, they pretty much everything. Open bar, open everything. You can invite your friends. You can invite your family members. And it's just them. And they can be themselves there. They don't have to be guarded. And to me, Kevin Durant came to the table. Say it again.
Name dropper.
Thank you. And I asked him, I said, what do you think about this? He said, I know my teammates, and this was his first year with Golden State. In the first 3 months, I know my teammates more than I ever knew them in Oklahoma City because of this this investment that ownership is doing to make sure that we're together. And what it comes down to is the makeup, and going back to the makeup, it's knowing that young player, how Kevin Durant can get to know not only him, but his family and where he's from, and then be able to communicate well so that player can put it in good use, and then they can communicate well on the court. If it were done in baseball, and maybe it'll cost them $5 extra million to do so, I'm telling you right now, that makeup of that team, they're going to get to know each other better and know their family members better. Because right now, you go into any clubhouse, and I'm telling you, it is right here all the time. Yeah. By the way, my wife says hello.
I think that's a really good point, is that the makeup, we're thinking of makeup as like this player has a certain makeup, right? And we have to evaluate it. However, really what you're sort of saying is like, if we knew that player better, we would know how to deliver the message better.
Absolutely.
And so it's not on them necessarily, it can be on us too. Like, we need to figure it out. And because Jeff Samardzija, I've talked to him so many times over the years, and a lot of times he's like, oh, pitching coach, and like rolls his eyes. And this year, he got a new pitching coach, and he's like, yeah, we're going to go look at the Edutronic video. And I'm like, what? What did you just say? And I don't know how he did it, honestly, but Jeff Samardzija is a veteran who's been around forever, and some of his pitching coaches, I probably would say that he has bad makeup and he doesn't listen and blah, blah, blah. But you know, his new pitching coach somehow got the message over, and it was probably by sort of getting to know him or you know, trying to do a low stress, or I don't know what it was.
But you hit on something, I think, Eduardo, that I think the eyes get rolled a lot on. I mean, we call it clubhouse chemistry a lot, and I understand that gets eye-rolled, but basically it's workplace dynamics, right? I mean, that's what it is. Those of us who've worked in office settings or around other people, know that it's a much more pleasant work environment if you're around people that you like working with and that you're having success with, as opposed to, you know, and one bad apple can spoil the pot, and it makes it more difficult to focus on what you're doing. And I do think that there are still some teams in baseball. I know that the Diamondbacks were one of them last year. Their first road trip in Los Angeles, they set up a group text, and that first night after a game, I think it was after a game or it was on an off day, they had, what, 25 players on the trip, plus a couple maybe others. I think they had something like 18 or 19 of them that went to dinner and all were around each other. I think there are teams that do that. They want to create that family atmosphere. I think that's part of what you're looking for, is creating a work environment that's fun. And I think if you work alone, if you're in, and listen, I've been able to have both aspects of this because I've worked at home for 7 years, and now I've been back kind of in a work setting for the last two plus with the D-backs. Like, there's advantages to both of them, but losing that or not having that gives you less of an understanding of how you have to interact with people in order to be invested in others' success.
Yeah, and, you know, I can, I mean, I've talked to Sean Casey about the 90 Reds, and he'll tell you about how much fun they had together. But it even goes beyond fun. I had interviewed a guy who was on your 2013 championship Red Sox, and he said that it was his first year with the club, and he said that the tone of that club was so magical. He said that he said, it's not about being happy. It's about learning. He said, I worked harder. He said, I never considered myself a slacker. He said, I was getting to the ballpark 2 hours earlier. One of the things that you did, you redid the family room, right? And so his wife, there was no more tension there about, oh, you got to go to the ballpark. You know, go. And he was so, his mind was so free. He was talking more about hitting to his teammates. He became a fundamentally better player because he was on a team that had good chemistry. It wasn't even about liking each other. It was about being in an environment where he could thrive and he can practice his craft. By the way, I want to remind you to questions, put them on note cards. Jeff, do you have some already? Why don't you bring them up? And as we do that, let's just talk about, shift gears completely and talk about shifts. We're seeing, we've seen a peaking. We've seen the king of shifts, Joe Maddon, go the other direction. What do you make of where the industry is right now with the information flow and the interpretation of defensive shifts?
I mean, I think we're to the microdata standpoint, right? So you're looking for every little edge that can give you something of an advantage. And I think, I don't know, again, there might be somebody else here who works for a team that might be able to answer this better, but it does seem to me that, you know, when teams like Milwaukee started shifting heavily in 2011, they were doing it to cover up for the fact that their middle infielders were Ricky Weeks and Yunesky Betancourt. You know, and so, I mean, listen, those guys were pretty good offense players. I saw Ricky Weeks still takes the best batting practice in the world, and he hasn't been a regular in the big leagues in, what, 5 years. So what they did was try and find ways, okay, how can we win games by moving these guys around? And maybe some of it became unnecessary, or maybe it's just that there's still a lot more shifting that's going on, but it's a lot more minor. And you have to, like, if you have a really athletic shortstop, there's not nearly as much of a need to shift. If you have somebody who is like Yunesky Betancourt that might be rangely challenged, and you need to put him in a position to make the most outs possible. In the end, it's about recording outs quicker, and with fewer runs on the board than any other way. And so I would think that that's where a lot of it goes. But again, there might be somebody on this panel that has a better idea of that.
In 2013, when I was with the Astros, I was in charge, actually, of the shifting. And the data was coming in. It was in its infancy at the time with the Astros. But one thing I can tell you is I think at that time, we shifted more than anyone else. It was ridiculous. It was over-exaggerating, trying to compensate for the pitching also, not just for the range of our infielders, even though we did have Altuve at second base, and it was really good. But I think teams and organizations are still shifting, even though it's at a less amount of rate, but they're shifting differently. It's not just the infielders. It's the outfielders. It could be just five steps to your left instead of all the way in the other side of the infield. Mm-hmm. And they've become smarter because of the data, knowing situations, when to shift, when not to. I remember in 2013, Troy Tulowitzki, we decided to shift him. And then with two strikes, we actually moved Altuve back to the other side. And then all of a sudden got 2-2 and we moved him back. And he stepped out and just looked into our dugout and goes, "Really?" And I said, "Okay, we got to him. We got him." He proceeded to hit a double off the wall. But it comes down to the point where the play offensively, where it used to affect David Ortiz back in the day and it affected Logan Morrison, hitters have become smarter, organizations have become smarter, and I think this is where now it's evolved more into what we've always heard about the launch angle with the exit velocity, that combination. Today I was at the Brewers camp. They had a screen on top of the turtle cage so they don't hit a lot of fly balls, but they also had a screen on the infield where they didn't want you to hit a ground ball or a straight line drive. They wanted it right in between into that projected exit angle that they wanted, into the launch angle that they wanted, and try to practice. So teams continue to evolve to try to beat the defense. And this is what I love about this game, that cat and mouse game. Once you got better and you think you've perfected something, here comes somebody else and outsmarts you with it.
Emil, anything to add on
this? Yeah, no, I think one of the things that's interesting about the evolution of shifting and probably the people that are in here that are with the team probably know, I mean, there's obviously we have a ton of data. We have people in the office that can sift through that data and help articulate that data. And so much of it goes back to the coaches that you have too. You know, I mean, we have Dave McKay who spends a lot. I mean, this guy does not stop. Like, he is all the time looking at, outfield defense and shifting. And, I mean, for those people who remember what we did to LeMahieu last year, you know, he came up with that. I mean, that was you know, so we shifted LeMahieu over. You know, AJ was basically right center. JD was on the line, like literally. And Peralta was in, I think Peralta was in the outfield, and he was in center. And LeMahieu hit a line drive that was literally right at AJ Pollock in right center field because that's where he pitched him. And I think, and obviously Mac was, you know, there was some satisfaction to that, which was great. We didn't do it every time, and then we got into his head, right? And Greinke, you know, like, might not want us to shift like that, whereas somebody else might. And so there is a bit of that cat and mouse game that you're not seeing. Everybody's, well, why'd you do it last time and you didn't do it this time? And then when we were in Boston, we had Brian Butterfield. He was unbelievable with it. I mean, spent hours and hours and hours on it. So I think the coaches you have to have the right coaches that, you know, that can understand and articulate the data and the information. You know, in addition to having all the information, and so that's a huge component to it.
Yeah, I think there's some fun things coming. I talked to Sam Fold a lot about switching left field when he was a player, switching left fielders and right fielders based on who's at bat. If you got a better defender in the corner outfield, put him in the pull field. I was thinking about there's got to be some pitchers that are athletic enough to cover first on a right-hander shift. So that's, I think, something like that could happen. You could have, that Anthony Rizzo has the second baseman's glove. Anybody who plays fantasy knows about that. You could have just the shortstop and second baseman switch positions because your shortstop might have more range and you've got a lefty up there who only pulls his ground balls. So I think that, I think it's fun. I think some people will roll their eyes at it, but I think it's fun. It's something we haven't seen so much before. I know the hitters are annoyed by it, but they can also learn to bunt.
Yeah. You know what's really cool? I was sent a picture earlier on this year, and I sent it out, and I sent it to my dad. It was sent to my dad. Everybody talks about the four-man outfield. Mm-hmm. It's soon to come. You're going to see it prevalent. Well, it was, I believe, in 1969 where the Cincinnati Reds did it to Willie McCovey in Candlestick, and it was a four-man outfield.
Who did they take out of the infield?
Excuse me?
Who did they take out of the infield?
Actually, they took the shortstop, and they put him in the outfield.
Wow.
And I still have the picture. I'll send it to you. We'll talk later. But it's really cool to see. Back in 1969, Dave Bristol was the manager for the Reds, if I'm not mistaken. It was right before Sparky, so it could have been 67. Where he was the manager for the Reds, and then he pulled that play off, and my dad said, "You see, I'm telling you guys, This data stuff, we do it before. I tried.
Wow.
I told you we were a lot more fun than the first group.
Well, you know, that really segues right into the next question.
Really?
How valuable is it having multilingual players? I'm taking that as a multilingual comment. Well, why is it not a, why is there not a bigger push in the Players Association or in clubs to have to maybe to help teaching American players Spanish?
There's a couple things. I actually don't see it too much as multilingual as it should be multicultural. Also, I believe it's important that you should know where the player comes from. And again, we heard, for those of you that were here in the first segment, hearing of its DeRosa's story that Brian Kenny said about when he was actually, it was in the Dominican Republic, and no one picked him up, he didn't know where to go. And from my experience, I used to be that interpreter for the guys when they did the eye test, when they did it with the doctors. There's a lot of educating that has to go on both sides, but the players that played winter baseball when they were young, they have an advantage when they come back. And I'm not talking about the Latino players. I'm talking about the American players in general. When they play winter baseball, they realize how difficult it is to be able to be a minority here when it comes to being a Latino and be able to go through what they are going here, not only with missing their family, economically not having what they could possibly have, but also just within the daily routine. And it's a process. And to be able to understand that aspect of it makes that American player actually a lot better in the clubhouse. It makes them more understanding, more compassionate when it comes to that minority player, if it's he's being Latino or if he's being Japanese. By the way, props to my Nihongo Josie here. Scotia, I know a little bit of Japanese too. So, but I played in Japan, and that also adds to it. There's an understanding to it. And once you get a teammate like that, to me, it takes it to another level. Eric Burns, which is phenomenal when it comes as a clubhouse guy. We know all the energy that he has in MLB Network. But that guy was considered in the Dominican Republic. He played every year, and he was called Capitan America. That's what it was. He was always diving everywhere, not only with the athletic uniform and with the Diamondbacks uniform, but also he was there in the Dominican Republic playing every year doing the same thing. And once you embrace that, it gives you that understanding and as far as your teammates. And I think that's important. It's just not being multilingual. Even though as important it is, yes, to know Spanish, but it's more important to be that multicultural and diverse guy in that clubhouse.
Yeah, that's terrific perspective. I want to go to the questions here. We've seen this free agent market. We've talked about it. Next year, what do we expect next year with Machado and Harper coming into the market, teams who are avoiding the luxury tax threshold will this year to reset their penalties might consider going over next year. Do we expect more of a back to what we used to see somewhere in between? What do you think, Mike?
Yes, I do think so. And I think, you know, you're looking, especially with those guys who are looking at 10 plus year deals with probably multiple opt-outs to try and take advantage of how the market dynamics change. But yeah, I absolutely think it's going to go back, because if all of these teams are sitting at now and saving their money for Machado and Harper, let's say there's 20 teams or so that may want to bid in those, and that's probably a little rich, but let's say it's 20 because some teams have sat out the market and some others are under the luxury tax and want to reset for that. Only two of those teams are going to get those players. And you know what? Then there's going to be some panic that sets in. And like, we didn't get Manny Machado, we're going to need a third baseman. And then they're going to pay probably a larger contract, or at least larger in terms of length than maybe you would want to for, say, a Josh Donaldson. Or maybe it's Mike Moustakas, who follows up 38 homers with another 30 this year, and he ends up with a multi-year deal. And then we're talking about, geez, well, these teams are doing this, but there's the aging curve, and they're ignoring it now. What did they not learn from last winter? But I do think that because, a rising tide carries all ships, right? So you're going to have this tide at the top of the market with those guys, potentially Kershaw and Keuchel, that are going to help to bring up the rest of that and make a lot of players that are available, because there are teams that are hoarding money for next winter that ain't going to get their top targets.
Yeah. Eduardo, thoughts on it?
Well, he hit it right on the nose. I was listening the whole way. There's not really much you can add except there's so many star-studded players that are going to be out there, and one of them that I think is going to capitalize even bigger than all those guys is Charlie Blackman. The more I see him, the more I like him, and you can put Colorado, you can take the stadium out of it. This guy is going to be an impact player one way or another, and that market is, we can call it luxury tax all you want, or you can call it a cap all you want. The bottom line is the organizations next year are bracing for it, and we see it being a perfect storm for that group, and hopefully Moustakas will be able to get his money. But
yeah.
it's setting up for an interesting year next year when it comes to the free agency, and this is where I have to just let the D-backs decide.
Now, I was going to skip you on this one.
Pass.
Yeah, exactly. We wouldn't expect you to weigh in on this.
This is a family feud. You can't just pass.
I'm passing.
No, he has to.
To possibly wet blanket a little bit, I mean, there are different ways to look at, especially the guys, the teams at the top. Like, say the Giants aren't that great this year. They lose Bumgarner in 2019. How much are they going to actually spend? The Tigers are not going to jump back in. Just yet, and what do we see from the Yankees? Is this only about the cap, or are they trying to like stay under 250, or like also the Yankees want pitching. I feel like, I mean, I guess they could go after Machado, but there can be excuses, is what I'm saying. There could be excuses again next year.
There could be, but I think you've raised a good point in that. And the 237 is really, that's the other number that you need to keep in mind, because if you cross that threshold in payroll, your top pick goes back 10 spots, which means you lose 10 spots of money in that too. And also,
that's the pick that gives you real players.
Right, and if you're somebody who's picking 15th, the difference with the quality of player from 15 to 26 or
it's
15
huge.
To 25 is pretty significant in what tends to be available in a draft.
Yeah.
I think the CBA really needs to be worked on.
Well, we're just about at the end of our time. I do want to make one correction. I can't believe when I introduced you, I didn't mention your 13 years in the major leagues.
Oh, I
don't know. My apologies, Eduardo. Of all the things I credited you with.
Oh, you're just so approachable. Forget that you did.
And did he tell you Steph Curry's a friend of his, too? I don't know if he told you that. Anyway. Well, with that, we're at the end of our time. How about a round of applause for our panel?